Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Preston Road Church. We are so glad that you're here today. I was one of the lucky ones, as Farland mentioned, that was in our parking lot at 5 this morning, seeing all three of my kids off to camp. Yep, it's going to be a wild time this week. Lots of naps going on at our house. But I'm really grateful for our youth ministry, and I'm grateful for all those who lead it, and we are praying that God will be with all of those who have gone to camp, and with those of us for whom the caffeine is running out right about now. We've been up a while. If you're a guest, we're so glad that you're here. We want to welcome you to our worship assembly. I hope that you will stick around and let us get to meet you. My wife Aubrey and I will stand at the back, and I hope that you will come up and introduce yourselves to us. We would like to get to know you and welcome you to worship with us here at the Preston Road Church. I want to say a particular word about one guest who's special to me today, Lynn McMillan, who's one of my elders at Memorial Road, where I came from. Lynn's with us today. You may remember we've talked about Lynn some. Lynn was planning to be here on the first Sunday I preached, but was unable to do that at the time. But he has supported me through the transition. Lynn is Distinguished Professor of Bible and Dean Emeritus of the College of Biblical Studies at Oklahoma Christian University, and I came to know him through those capacities, but particularly in his role as an elder at the Memorial Road Church. He was the primary one who hired me back in 2008 when I was 26 and had no idea what I was doing in ministry, and was my primary supervising elder for almost the whole 14 years I was there, until I was 41 and only kind of knew what I was doing in ministry. Lynn has been a great support to me through difficult times. If there are things I do in ministry that you think make sense or are well done, it is a credit to those who have been around me. And it's a credit to elders who have been by my side and supported me when I've made mistakes, encouraged me when I've done well. So good elders are really important for ministers, and that's part of the reason that I also was willing to come here, because I know we have a great eldership here. That makes all the difference, as you can imagine, when the elders have your back, when you do things in ministry that are important, sometimes when you make mistakes. I'm really thankful for Lynn, and I'm very glad that you are here today. Thank you for being here to be an encouragement to Aubrey and me, and thank you for being my shepherd for 14 plus years through my time at school and time at Memorial Road. You cannot conceive, nor can I, of the appalling strangeness of the mercy of God. That's a quote from the priest in Graham Greene's novel, Brighton Rock. But that's not where I first heard this quote. I first heard this quote from the mouth of a fictional president who's pacing the floors of the National Cathedral. Show that scene up on the screen. Any of you recognize where this came from? It came from President Josiah Bartlett in the show The West Wing. Any fans of that show in here? Anybody recognize this scene? One of the best moments on television. And in this period, President Bartlett is pacing the floors of the National Cathedral and having a pretty intense one-on-one with the Almighty. A storm is brewing, and Bartlett is having it out with God. Several things have happened to him to lead up to this scene. His longtime executive assistant has just passed away in a tragic car accident. A naval vessel is in the path of destruction. His deputy chief of staff is still recovering from a gunshot wound that was actually aimed at him, the president. And he, the president, is taking a public shellacking for failing to disclose a medical condition. And so in part English and part Latin, he's asking God some pretty pointed questions. And he says, "Am I really to believe that all these punishments are the work of a loving God, a just God, a wise God?" And he is in effect saying, "Is this what your mercy looks like? Because it's pretty strange." In the book of Numbers, another storm is brewing. God's people have betrayed him again, and God is angry, and he's out to punish them. In fact, their destruction is imminent because of God's anger and because of their betrayal. Now, what led up to this moment? Well, God has for a long time been promising his people this land in Canaan, and so now they're close to it, and they're going to send out spies and see what it will take for them to own this land. What will it take for us to go in and take it as God has promised? So they send out 12 spies, and they come back with mixed reports. 10 of the spies come back and say, the people are too big, they're too strong, there's no way we can do this. And 2 spies come back, and they don't deny those reports. They say, yo, you're right, all that's true, but the Lord is with us. He said he's going to be with us, he's faithful, we can take this land. And so there's a back and forth and an argument and a question of leadership. And the spies get up and give their reports. And the people say, no, no, we can't do it. There's no way we can. In fact, we should have just stayed in Egypt. It would have been better there. And so they want to stone their leaders and overthrow them. And God is not happy because the people have demonstrated once again faithlessness when he has promised to be faithful. And so just like in the book of Exodus that we looked at last week, God's people have been unfaithful, and he's ready to punish them. So our teeth are sort of on edge. What's going to happen here? And the only thing standing right now between God's people and complete destruction is a word. It's a word. And Moses is going to utter that in a minute. But let's read what God says in back a few verses, in Numbers chapter 14, verses 11 and 12, this is what God says in response to their betrayal. God says, how long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe in me in spite of all the signs I've performed among them? I will strike them down with a plague and destroy them, but I will make you, he's talking to a Moses, into a nation greater and stronger than they. I think it's interesting the language God uses here. You may be familiar with lament psalms where the psalmist will say, how long, how long? Well, God's got his own lament here. How long am I going to put up with you? How long is this going to keep going? And he basically says, oh, you thought the plagues you saw in Egypt were bad? You thought the frogs and gnats were bad? Well, wait till you see what I can do to you. Here comes some plagues on you. And so Moses is a little wary of this, understandably. Now, Moses himself would be spared from this, but he's going to once again advocate for the people amid God's anger. And so Moses gives 2 rebuttals to God. Here's what's at stake, God, if you do this. And the first thing is, what will the Egyptians think? You just brought them out of that land. You saved them. What are they going to think if you bring them out here and kill them? Is this a deal of, you can't kill them, let me do it myself? That won't look very good. The second rebuttal is what we're going to focus on today. The second thing Moses does is to call God to be who God said he is. In the text we read last week in Exodus 34, God gives this long self-disclosure, all these qualities that he said he is. And Moses is going to call him on that and say, this is who you said you were. So that's where we get the text for today. In Numbers chapter 14, verses 17 through 19, Moses says, may your strength be displayed just as you have declared. The Lord is slow to anger, abounding in love and forgiving sin and rebellion. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children for the sin of the parents to the 3rd and 4th generation. In accordance with your great love, forgive the sin of these people, just as you have pardoned them from the time they left Egypt until now. So Moses starts off by saying, you know, to be forgiving is a sign of strength, right? That's how he starts off. May your strength be displayed. So it's not weak to forgive. That's showing strength. It's showing strength to forgive people. It's not weakness. And then Moses now says back to God what God said to him. And he lists all those qualities. And if you notice, particularly, Moses calls upon God's great love and the one request he makes is to forgive these people. And this is where their fate hangs, on this one word, forgive. What is God going to do? But Moses distills all God said he was into this one word, forgive. For better or worse, this is how Moses summarizes God, and this is what he calls God to do in this moment. Forgive. So here's all these things you said you were, and out of that, of course, you would forgive these people, wouldn't you? And so God responds. Verse 20. The Lord replied, I have forgiven them, as you asked. Nevertheless, surely as I live, and as surely as the glory of the Lord fills the whole earth, not one of those who saw my glory and the signs I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, but who disobeyed me and tested me 10 times, not one of them will ever see the land I promised on oath to their ancestors. Not one who has treated me with contempt will ever see it. So God responds and he says, you know what, I have forgiven them, just as you asked. But there's more to the story. So Moses has asked God to be a forgiving God, and God agrees to that. But God also said that he is a God who does not leave evil unpunished. And so he has to be that too. And in this case, God says, you know, if you were alive and you watched what I did to bring you out of Egypt, then you're not going to make it to the next phase. If that didn't convince you that I'm faithful, then I don't know what to do with you. And so God forgives, but he also punishes. So just notice what's happening here. Moses is asking God to be part of what he revealed. God says, I must be all of what I revealed. So God is going to demonstrate love and forgiveness, but he's also going to demonstrate here that he cannot let guilt go unpunished. The thing we learn from this story is that you cannot have God's mercy without also having God's justice. You can't have one without the other. We know how this works in Scripture. So many times we can see this principle at work. It goes all the way back to the story of Adam and Eve. So when they sin and eat what they're not supposed to and then lie about it, they are expelled from the garden, so they're punished, but they're also clothed. And even a chapter later, when Cain is in trouble for killing his brother, he is sent out, but he's given a mark to keep him safe. So there's mercy and justice going together. The whole story of the Israelites in Egypt, these two principles. There's no way God can show mercy on his people without showing justice to the Egyptians. You've got to have them both. But maybe my favorite story about this is Zacchaeus. Here's a person who is reviled by his own people because he's extorting money from them. They didn't like his profession. But he hears Jesus is going to be in town, and so he wants to see this person he's heard about. And so some of you grew up maybe singing the song about him climbing up in the tree to see Jesus. He wants to know who this man is that so many are talking about. And so Jesus says, not only am I going to acknowledge you, Zacchaeus, but you're going to come to my house. I'm going to come to your house. I'm going to be a guest at your place. And this doesn't sit well. So Luke tells us this story in Luke 19, beginning in verse 7. The people see this, and they begin to mutter, Jesus has gone to be the guest of a sinner. But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, 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 here and now I give half my possessions to the poor, and if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back 4 times the amount. Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. Zacchaeus, this wee little man in the tree, as we sang as kids. But Zacchaeus understands that receiving God's mercy also means some justice, doesn't it? And he understands in this moment that Jesus is showing mercy to me. He is coming to my house. He is granting me salvation and forgiveness. But that means in this moment that the people I've wronged, I've got to make that right. There's not just this blanket forgiveness without a demand for justice. God has to right the wrongs, and Zacchaeus knows this. You can't have God's mercy without having God's justice. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a church leader and a theologian and really an activist in many ways in Germany during World War II, wrote about this tension in his book, The Cost of Discipleship. And he talks about something called cheap grace that we all struggle with. See if this sounds familiar to you. He says, cheap grace is forgiveness without requiring repentance. It's baptism without church discipline, communion without confession. Cheap grace is grace without discipleship, grace without the cross, grace without Jesus Christ. You felt that tension sometimes? It's a very attractive concept. This is, cheap grace is really the mercy without any of the justice. And it sounds great, and we're all drawn to it, but it is an incomplete picture of who God is and what he asks of us. And in contrast, Bonhoeffer talks about costly grace. He says, costly grace is a gracious call to follow Jesus. It's a word of forgiveness to the broken spirit and the contrite heart. It is costly because it compels someone to submit to the yoke of Christ and follow him. It is grace because Jesus says, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. You feel this tension sometimes? It's really easy to gravitate toward one or the other. Sometimes it's in our personal lives. Sometimes it's how we look at the world. So sometimes we might get caught up in sin and we cling so vigorously to the mercy of God, which we should, but we forget about the justice of God that demands obedience and repentance. Sometimes, by the way, it's the opposite, where we're harder on ourselves than we are on anyone else, and we think God's justice is coming for us, even though we're willing to admit his mercy will show up for everyone else. And that's a tough spot to be in. Sometimes it shows up in society when issues come up, and people want to, maybe there's some social issue that we are trying to figure out, and you've got the mercy people and the justice people, and they're talking past each other because their heart's in the right place and they can quote the right scriptures, but they're not having the same conversation. Sometimes it's generational. So you'll hear one generation say, well, you know, where my parents or grandparents went to church, it was just all hellfire and brimstone every Sunday. And you'll hear other generations say, well, all they talk about is love, love, love of God. Just mercy and grace. Kind of dismissively about how that works. And it is true, isn't it? We tend to swing that pendulum back and forth. And it's really hard to figure out how to incorporate both of those. And I've about decided that the win here is not that we all have absolute agreement on where that balance is, but that we acknowledge there's a tension. That we don't try to silence one part of God and silence one group of people who's advocating for that part of God. That we live in that tension that says you cannot have God's mercy without having God's justice. And so anytime these things come up, whether it's my personal failing, whether it's some issue we need to figure out, whether it's talking about what the preaching and teaching should be like in the life of a church, that one attribute of God does not get to silence the other. That they're both there. And so this passage teaches us where Moses has said, here's all you are, so please be forgiving. And God says, that is all I am, and I am forgiving, and I'm a few other things as well. And all of those things go in the mix. And I don't think when we hear those things, it causes us to be scared of God. It causes us to be thankful. Because here's the thing. None of us really wants to live in a world that's unjust. We don't want to live in a world where God doesn't punish evil. It's difficult to figure that out sometimes, but when we look out and see evil running rampant, and we see how people might be mistreated, and we want God to get the bad guys, whatever that looks like. But we all have that instinct. None of us truly wants a God who is only merciful and never just. We want that. And the key is not that we all agree on exactly where that balance is going to be each time, because that's tough, but that we acknowledge that both attributes are part of who God is, both of them are present, and we don't get to silence one or the other. God is a God who is both merciful and just. And that's what we gather each Sunday to do. We confess the full nature of God. And so we can call on God to be merciful, just as we call on God to be just. We can, out one side of our mouth, confess that God is the God who forgives, while the other side of our mouth also confesses that God is the God who does not let evil go unpunished. And so we gather here today to worship the full nature of this God who has disclosed himself to us. And so at this time, let us stand and continue to worship that God.